Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us this week. This is the second part of a special, very special two-part episode that we did here, looking at the applications of wilderness EMS and wilderness medicine to the urban EMS and disaster preparedness arena. And part of what makes this episode so special is that we have been able to find a way to offer special CME credit for those seeking a Wilderness Medicine Society fellowship. So you can get credit towards a WMS fellowship by listening to both the first episode in this two-part episode and this episode. And during each episode, there will be several keywords mentioned, and you will have to write down those keywords and the time on your podcast player in each episode where those keywords are played or mentioned, and then you will get credit when you turn all of that in. You can turn all of that in to Terry, T-E-R-I, at WMS.org. And there'll be more information on where to turn that in at the end of this episode as well. But you want to pay attention. I'll be coming in during the discussion periodically to mention what the keyword is. And when I mention that keyword, you look down at your podcast player, note the time, and keep track of all five of the keywords mentioned in the first episode and this episode. There are five total in both episodes. So you want to note that, and you can get the credit towards the WMS fellowship. So without further ado, let's jump on into this episode. We pick up with Sam Bradley's question of our panelists. What is that essential piece of gear or equipment you would want to have with you when stuck in a wilderness setting?
Speaking of gear, I have a question I want to ask David, Ben, and Seth, and then Joe, because I know what Joe's answer is to this, because I threw this question on him during a podcast. But starting with David, if you're in the backcountry, what is the one piece of equipment you could not live without?
That is a good, very good question. And I actually want to approach this first from just a general standpoint, as far as, you know, preparing to spend a night in the woods and tent essentials and that kind of stuff. And I think it's actually water filtration. If you learn some basic survival skills like Kevin advocates as being a part of the SAR skill set, you can improvise shelter, you can improvise fire, you can improvise signaling devices. But if you are going to be lost and people are going to be looking for you for a few days, especially this time of year in Kentucky, for example, you need to be able to drink water. And, you know, if I had to balance out the risk of drinking contaminated water with dying from dehydration, I'd probably just go ahead and go with the contaminated water. But it would be better if I could safely sustain myself for a period of time. And being able to stay hydrated is going to contribute to my mental state and my overall health and my ability to use all those other skills and improvise tools to be able to get myself out of that situation. So I would go with an ability to drink water. I think that's pretty fundamental. But from a medical standpoint, I think it's all about versatility. So I don't know if I could really pick, you know, one piece of gear that could serve all purposes in a medical standpoint. But I'm really attracted to medical devices that can do a few different things. Keep that pack weight low and cut down on sort of the cognitive decision-making point where you have to select the very specific right piece of equipment. You know, you don't want to be carrying a crash cart on your back full of lots of very specific types of things. You really want, just a few items that can be used for lots of different purposes.
Wow, that's major. Okay, so Ben, assume you have your water situation under control. What is something else that you can't live without?
So I'm going to say this in three parts. One, as I tell all my medics and my juniors, you know, no matter what, where you're at or what situation, three things you never leave home without are your brain, your mind, your heart, and your hands. So knowing how to use those three things and put them to work, you can usually figure things out. In the actual physical sense, you know, what equipment, first I'd say from a non-medical perspective, but really still a medical perspective, would be my knife. I'll drink contaminated water if I have to. Different things, but I can do a lot of different things with my knife, from make communication devices, making splints, even medically, if I need to, I might do a stab thoracotomy or do different things, a surgical airway. You know, we talk about that in movies and all, but realistically, if someone has a tension pneumo or anything and I don't have a large needle, I can do something with a knife. I can make different cuts and kind of glue things over. I'd like also some super glue with that too. I might be able to stitch or Dermabond. And as I'll kind of hop on also from a more medical standpoint in terms of, you know, commercial equipment, what David was saying is I prefer things that have combo value, that are small, that are light. But if I only could do one thing other than the knife, would probably be roll bandaging of some sort, because I can make a tourniquet with it, or I can do pressure dressings, or I can shove it in an orifice or whatever I need to, as well as make splints out of it.
Okay, folks, I'm going to jump in here. It's time for another one of our CME keywords, so get ready. The word is hydration. So go ahead and write that down. Hydration is our keyword, and note the elapsed time on your podcast episode player. This is going to be the second half of this two-part episode, so you will be writing this down for the second episode that you've caught of this two-parter. And the first keyword in that second episode is hydration. And go ahead, take it away, guys.
So, Kevin, you want to jump in on this?
Sure. I'm going to echo Ben's answer, and I'm going to say my knife. Mainly because I can make tools, I can purify water via starting a fire, I can cut the wood needed to make a hand drill or a bow drill to start a fire, and there's multiple ways to purify water after you filter it if you have a fire and some basic knowledge. And again, bandages. I can make cordage from a number of other stuff. But the knife, to me, is the most important tool that I can ever have in the backcountry, wilderness, outdoors, whatever, just because you can not only use it as a tool, but make so many other things with a knife. If you need to make a splint or a litter or, you know, just 100 different things, having a knife makes it so much easier and a lot less time-consuming. So a knife would be my primary.
I think it's pretty clear that I would die in a backcountry survival situation. I think that's what the listeners will learn from this podcast. Go ahead.
We've scared them all off to ever wanting to go into the woods.
But David,
you'll be well hydrated.
Yeah.
I'll tell you.
So Seth, we saved almost the best almost for last. What's your thought on it?
Yeah, so I would echo Ben and take the sneaky answer and say the brain. So we do a lot of training on this in wilderness medicine, and I think it's a really important message, and Ben mentioned it. You know, there's so much evidence that people who are motivated and trained can thrive for weeks and months in the wilderness. People who become panicky and who lose faith and forget even the basics of what they know die very quickly. We live in a society that's very product-driven, so I think we're trained to think about what we can buy to go out and be effective in the wilderness. And I think all the things that are described are definitely like top 10 essential lists, and outdoor vendors love it that there's a 10 essentials list that you have to have, you know, that you have to go out and buy the stuff to use it. And I agree. All those would be things I wouldn't walk out the door with. In my rugby team in college, our medical kit was first aid tape and vodka. And I think I can do a lot with first aid tape and vodka.
I like it.
But I think
aesthetic, right?
it's hugely important how well you use your brain and how well you protect it. So I think the thing I really liked about what David's saying is that hydration is crucial to your brain working well. Keeping yourself fueled with food is crucial to your brain working well. So I think the most important thing to me in a survival setting is doing those things that keep my brain working well, because that's what's going to protect me as time goes by. It's what's going to let me make good decisions in my patient care, and it's what's going to let me improvise a knife or make good decisions about how I can treat the water or what water choices, you know, I make and all the other things, you know, fashioning bandages or ropes or things like that. So to be even a little bit sneakier, and this is very heretical to the outdoor enthusiast world, but I think many of us now have peripheral brains we carry around that that are these smartphones. Now, these are just absolutely amazing tools, and we really live in the Jetsons world, and I don't think we really recognize just in the last, you know, since I was a kid, in the last 30 years, what tools have been put into our hands. So I carry now a smartphone with me. I carry a case that's ruggedized to protect against the environment. The case has a built-in battery. I carry at least one solar battery charger with me as well, because these tools now can be signaling tools. They can be patient information tools. They can remind me about principles of care. As my brain maybe deteriorates, I can look stuff up. They can be signaling devices. They can be GPSs and have compasses in them. They can even give me a map. I can call 911 with them, and 911 dispatch centers now increasingly can actually get my location from them. I can write SOAP notes on them. So just to say, the brain, I think, is going to end up being the most important tool anybody has in the wilderness, and the ability of these electronic peripheral brains that are now available to us and the apps that are available, many of them for free on them, are just truly astounding. And there's an argument against using battery-powered electronics in the wilderness, and I'm a little bit of a skeptic to that, because I think the tools that you get from that, while you can't rely on it, if it is functional, can absolutely transform your patient care and an operation.
That's not where I was expecting you to go, Seth, but you made some really good points about that. As long as you're able to charge the thing. But like you said, they come with batteries in them, extra batteries in the case. And I have a charger that you can charge like 14 things on it, so it would last quite a while. So, Dr. Joe Hawley, I saved you for last, and you know why, because I know what you're going to say, but these guys don't. So what is the one thing that you would want to have with you in a wilderness environment?
Well, so I'm going to have to really go with I guess, a couple of points that Seth just made. And I think in my take-home message from Seth is invest in yourself, not in toys or products or gimmicks that get sold to help people take care of themselves. So, you know, I think it's your brain. But kudos to Seth, because he, through his brilliance of recommending that you bring vodka along, has generated yet another use for the Foley catheter, and that is to plug up the bottle of vodka so that you don't spill any of it between uses.
You know,
so I'm back to the Foley catheter as the ultimate wilderness tool.
When you said before we started recording this about different uses of the Foley catheter, I was going to tell you specifically that, which I have done before. We lost the lid on our whiskey, our orange juice, and we used the Foley catheter to make a lid.
Perfect. Oh, there you go. See? It's perfect.
Now, Ben, given the wilderness context, yes. Were you concerned about introducing infection to the orange juice bottle?
No, I was
not. The alcohol will take care of it.
Gotcha. Okay, gotcha.
But, you know, and I'm, you know, empiric antibiotics, nah.
Kind of on the serious side of that question, could you use that as any kind of alcohol as like an antiseptic? I mean, I'm thinking back to the Wild West days when they not only would, you know, make them drink it so they had some anesthesia, but they used it as an antiseptic. So that's kind of a half serious question.
I think it would just depend on what it is you're trying to use. There's a lot of these things that are so sugary that I'd be kind of afraid to use as an antiseptic. Definitely an analgesic. You'd be able to use it for, but antiseptic, it really depends on what it is. Some of the stuff that I'll carry in camp, yeah, you probably could.
So on that note, could you guys think of what type of alcohol would be best for that use? Vodka, I'm hearing.
Yeah, this is David again. I recall reading a blurb from Chris Holstedge, who is a toxicologist, but also gets into wilderness medicine, kind of, I guess, through the envenomation route with University of Virginia. And to be honest with you, I can't remember if I read it in a magazine or if I actually heard him say it in person. I used to work in Virginia and attended a lot of his CME presentations. And he claims that he carries a flask of vodka with him whenever he goes hiking. And, you know, I'm not sure whether he's being more serious or more facetious, but I think it kind of reaffirms this point that we've all been talking about, that it has multiple uses. So it can be an antiseptic. It can be a comfort care kind of an item. It can even be used, you know, to maybe get the bladder functioning again in a hyponatremia type situation. And I think that that's kind of the quintessential example of a theme of this whole chat, which has been, you know, just simple stuff that can go a long way in a lot of different situations.
So we're getting ready to give you the next keyword, and the next keyword for you is Foley, F-O-L-E-Y, Foley. So go ahead and look at your player, look at the elapsed time, and jot that down as your next keyword for this CME segment, and you'll go ahead and be ready to turn that in. And again, we'll give you the email address where you can send that at the end of the episode. Go ahead, guys.
So I have another question. This is for everyone here. What do you think some of the biggest challenges for wilderness medicine providers are?
Well, I'll take a stab at this. One of the challenges...
You don't have a knife. You can't take a stab at it.
Oh, you beat me to it.
That's...
You forgot your knife, dude.
I know, yeah. I know. I
make the cut there, David.
He's not going to share his water with you, so there you go.
Yep. Water's all mine. I walked right into that. That was checkmate. I got nothing. I'm down out, guys. Podcast is over. But I think one of the biggest challenges for people who've been trained traditionally, which is pretty much everyone, right? You go through a traditional paramedic training program, for example, and then you get into wilderness medicine, and it's breaking away from that reliance on things. I remember when I learned that some of the real high-speed, austere medical providers in the military don't carry oxygen cylinders on their missions. If they have to put a patient on a ventilator, for example, they're just going to use FiO2 of 21% oxygen, of just ambient air. And it blew my mind because I was so used to having that D cylinder always handy and doing 100% oxygen, basically. So I think it's just breaking away from that reliance on all the bells and whistles and toys.
You know, that reminds me of something, David. When I was a new medic, I was getting on ski patrol and taking the crossover course. And I remember them asking me, okay, you've got a hair traction splint. I think this was before the Sager. You have a hair traction splint, but it doesn't have any straps on it. What are you going to do? I said, well, call for backup. He said, no, you're on a mountain and it's 32 degrees in the middle of a blizzard. What are you going to do? And that's when I realized, because I'm thinking, I'm a paramedic. I'm taking an advanced first aid class. What the heck? I got to know more than that, but that's when I realized I didn't. And you really got to adjust your thinking to, and you guys mentioned it earlier, you got to improvise. What do you have that you can improvise with? So, because that splint isn't going to do me any good if I can't, you know, strap it down and provide the traction. So just thought I'd throw that out.
That really is so true, and that's what we were, you know, talking about earlier as well. Muscle memory and being comfortable with skill sets and doing certain things so you can do it flawlessly and easily, like starting IVs and doing things like that in different situations and concentrate on other things, is really important in developing all that. However, you need to be innovative. You need to think, what else can I use when this doesn't work? What else can I use? Do I really need to do that? Do I need to carry it with me? The mentions in the article, when we talk about oxygen, you know, David, I'm so glad you said it. It was a perfect thing where you know, what would we do? Mona greets everyone at the door. You know, we got to give him oxygen and this and that. But how long is that oxygen really going to last? Are you carrying a D cylinder? Are you putting that on an ATV? No. And do they really need it? What's really going to make the difference? It's weighing out the cost versus the risk, similar to the helicopters even. You know, it goes big, it goes small. The skill sets, the equipment, you just really need to think about what can you do in different situations. What if you run out? What if you get five people that are hiking, even in an urban park, like a Goleta State Park, and they trip over each other? Or there's a concert, you know, let's say I'm here in Gainesville and there's a concert and multiple people are trampled and you need to splint their legs. It can happen. So what are you going to do? How many traction splints do you carry on an ambulance, David? One?
Yeah, just one.
Some of the units down south, I'm talking about my south, not your south. Sometimes I wonder if there's a traction splint at all. And I say that because they have it, they have the skills, but they sometimes get so used to such a quick transport time that they won't bother putting it on, or they get sidetracked. We, in inner city Miami and some of those regions around there, where we have a lot of penetrating trauma and GSWs and all, and they come in all the time with femur fractures, all the time. How often I've seen someone on a traction splint, I can easily count on one hand how many times I've seen one put on in the last 4 years, as opposed to me grabbing one from the ambulance and putting it on while in the trauma bay.
Joe, what are your thoughts on that?
Sorry, trying to get off mute. well, I think these guys have covered it pretty well. You know, the issues are similar across all those disciplines. And I don't know that I can sort of put my finger on any one thing. I think it probably is sort of rigid thinking and a dependency on being in our comfort zone that makes it really challenging for folks to be put in those environments. Now, we talk a lot about having physicians and other caregivers show up on disaster scenes and be completely unprepared for what they're doing and not have any understanding of what's going on there, put themselves at risk, and ultimately not be very productive. And I think all of that is just related to a lack of expectations or an expectation that is completely unrealistic for the environment.
Good point, Joe. Seth, you had some thoughts. I think you want to jump in there.
Well, yeah, we've discussed this, I think, on the podcast before, but I think one of the biggest challenges facing wilderness EMS providers and the evolution of the care in that environment is the perception of our house of medicine community about what it is that we do. There's still a really pervasive thought similar to, I think, what the perception was about EMS years ago and maybe still is the case in some areas, that really what we're doing is kind of a hobby or a secondary form of medical care. The fact that so much of what we do is what we're saying, improvisational and ad hoc, it can lend to the suspicion that this isn't really true medical care, that this is something which is just a hobby. And I think that's really dangerous. I think many of us are working towards a world where the care that you get on the top of a mountain, in a ski slope, in a cave, you know, being plucked from the water in the ocean in Miami by Ben, it is really of the same quality as it would be anywhere else in the chain of survival or in the house of medicine. And there's really no reason why evidence-based medicine shouldn't prevail in our arena, why training equally high with what they are for hospital-based providers. Expectations shouldn't be just as strong. And ultimately, I think what this boils down to, and here's where I'll kind of draw some controversy, is I really think that this needs to become the regulated practice of medicine like it is in any other operational world for medicine. So there's still a lot of question about the degree to which lifeguards or ski patrollers or other personnel are performing first aid or whether they're performing medical care. That has legal issues. It's got operational issues. It's got scope of practice issues. Many of us, I think, feel that EMS in general needs to move from less of a technician embodied practice and more into a clinician practice, which I think would really convey better what it is that we're doing. We're really performing clinical decision making in the field, and many times those doing care in these environments are really doing very high level medical decision making that's equivalent to anything being done by anyone in a hospital or anywhere else. And I think this also ties back, you know, to the disaster theme of the podcast, that the American and international population really demands a certain amount of professionalism from disaster responders that almost, it almost violates the definition of the word disaster, you know, which these things should be, should not be expected in wilderness, or disasters shouldn't be things we can prepare for. And yet we're expected now to prepare for them. So I think correspondingly with that, to me, one of the biggest challenges is just getting to a place where wilderness EMS and wilderness medicine is understood as far as what it means, what the credentials are. There's consistency between states about those credentials. There's a certain amount of professionalism in the providers that deliver it. And ultimately, we know what it means to be a wilderness EMT or a wilderness paramedic or even a wilderness physician, and what those scopes are and what the expectations in the public can be for them. So I know the wilderness medical school community is working on consensus standards for what some of these definitions are. The National Association of EMS Physicians is working on it. And I think that will be one of the big challenges to be overcome, is just building uniformity and consistent credentialing and scopes of practice in this industry that promote the idea that that really this is medical care like any other.
Good point, Seth. And on that note, I'm going to segue to my favorite subject, and I'm going to ask all of you this question. You may have the same answer or not, but in everything we've talked about, we've always gotten listener feedback on, gee, I want to learn how I can do that. So, Seth, I'll start with you. If someone, regardless of what medical level they are, or even if they're not, and they want to get into wilderness medicine, where should they start? What type of training gives them the, you know, because I was thinking earlier when you guys were talking, is it better to have a doctor learn wilderness medicine or somebody that knows wilderness medicine become a doctor? I mean, how does that all work? What do you think?
That's a classic question, and you know, a really great segue into take-home points where we can point people who are excited about this to resources they can use to actually build operational abilities. So, it, you know, just to kind of bring it home to one of our challenges, we've always wondered, is it, you know, given two equally qualified communities, is it better to train climbers to be EMS personnel, or is it better to train EMS personnel to be climbers? And I think what you really get at is many of these skills can be learned and are cognitive, and you could get in a classroom. Many of the, you know, outdoor skills, like being a climber, that's going to take years and years of specific recreational activities to kind of explore it. So I think, you know, getting down to the safety in the wilderness, one of my proudest moments as a medical director for an operational EMS team was when one of my paramedics was about to go over a rappel and said, you know what, this is, I'm sketched out. This is too much for me. And, when I get sketched out in the emergency department, it's usually because I'm scared for a patient, but it's not usually because I think I'm actually going to get myself hurt or make the situation worse. And I think that's really important to recognize limits and to know when you're talking about who should you train for these kind of environments, being very comfortable in the environment that you're in is really crucial in this sort of care. So on the one hand, should people want to get into this kind of work, I think any of the many organizations that offer environmentally specific wilderness training is great. Like, you definitely don't want to be anywhere near swift water if you're not a swimmer or you haven't taken a swift water rescue class. So I think, you know, being facile in the ocean is crucial before you think about doing any kind of lifeguarding there, or, you know, working at Everest ER is not going to be very effective if you don't have a good climbing background. So all those things I think are important. But then if you're going to pursue the specific medical aspect of this, and many people on this podcast can speak to this from their own particular backgrounds. There are a host of schools out there now that are doing outstanding work. Some of us, you know, on this podcast even own them or work for them. And really exploring those is only a Google search away of just looking at wilderness medicine. This is very interesting in that it's one of the few elements of medicine where the private industry of these schools has actually predated the academic development of the field. So wilderness medicine as a field really began more in depth from schools teaching it rather than people actually doing it operationally. And that's a pretty interesting thing from an educational standpoint. So many of these schools have got 50 years behind their belt of training people to do wilderness medicine and are very, very experienced in getting those skill sets transferred over. And I'm sure when we wrap up, some of those websites can be shared.
Absolutely. And you remind me of the fact that wilderness medicine, just like any other kind of medicine, has so many different pieces and parts and specialties that, to be well-rounded, you pretty much have to learn all of them. David, what are your thoughts on this subject, as well as any take home that you want to give us?
Yes, I'm sorry. I was just taking a sip of cool, refreshing water. I would definitely echo tough crowd on the line. Yeah.
We're laughing on mute.
We're all muted. So.
You haven't seen the chat room, so.
I think some people may be trying to wound themselves with their knives to get out of this conversation at this point. But I would echo what Seth said, and I would kind of take it a little bit of a step further. So what he said about there being a lot of great providers of wilderness medical training out there doing lots of cool stuff. There are lots of different providers that have a little bit of a different bent or slant on, wilderness care, osteocare. And so I think if you're going to get into this stuff, regardless of which one of those courses you take and who you take it with, you have to be prepared to sort of challenge some of the status quo in medicine and in patient care. A lot of what wilderness medicine is about is slaying dogma, challenging the notion of, things like rigid C-collars and replacing them with blanket rolls. That's a simple example of something that can be really controversial. So I think you have to be prepared to have an open mind for some new approaches and new attitudes. And what I see a lot, I think, in that conversion process of traditional providers getting into wilderness medicine is that they're not quite prepared to do that. And so they misinterpret wilderness medicine as being a substandard level of care. And they don't take it seriously as a result. Those are my thoughts.
Well said. It wasn't as watered down as I thought it'd be.
Here, here. I agree completely. Greatly. Well, beautifully said.
Well, Kevin, you want to go ahead and jump in, and then we'll get Dr. Ben and Joe.
Yeah, I would just point everyone who either doesn't know about them, but a good place to start is the Wilderness Medical Society. It's a nonprofit organization. It was started by physicians, but it's open to any medical personnel from the EMT on up. You can find them at WMS.org, and they have tons of information. They have a journal they put out, lots of articles on the website, just a lot of really good information. So if you're looking to learn more about wilderness medicine, that would be a good starting point.
Good point, Kevin. And that's part of the reason we're here. So Dr. Ben, the star of our show, what are your parting thoughts and thoughts on the issue of training?
I'm trying not to just echo what the others were saying, but for the most part, I mean, the internet's a powerful tool. There's a lot of great resources and great people out there. It also just reminded me that one of the emergency medicine attendings down in Miami was recently asking me about what wilderness medicine training to do. He doesn't have a background in it. He's interested and wants to learn more. And I have to get back to him with some of the resources. But really, it's just reaching out is really important to do and finding out. And any of these different ones have different fields and finding out what works. As long as you do something, it's going to be beneficial. And the more you do, the more beneficial, because you're going to learn to think outside the box again. Sometimes certain classes aren't going to fit your schedule, but I don't want people to be discredited because it's like, I'd love to do that sort of thing, but I can't afford to go to this country or go and do that or do it at this time. And then you end up never doing it. Just go and do something. Seize the day, just as you would carpe donut, seize the donut. And there was another point I wanted to kind of make from it. Kind of backtracking for a quick second to what Seth was saying is also a big thing in challenge. I just want to reiterate that it's perception and changing things. People are afraid to do things. Good Samaritans, people don't understand Good Samaritan laws, even though they have training as a physician or they have training as a paramedic or an EMT. And people misrepresenting or misperceiving different roles. I know some of the people that I work with, if they were outside of the trauma center or the hospital, I wouldn't want them touching me because they're not familiar with that sort of things. But as soon as we're in the department and they have their tools, absolutely, they're the first ones that I would come on. So regarding the education, which direction should it go? There is no right answer as long as there's education. Education is the right answer.
Kevin, I think you had a question to throw out there to David.
Yeah, I was just trying to find the mute button. So one question, Dave, because I know you're involved in this. How can providers transition from front country or urban EMS to backcountry or wilderness medicine or EMS?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to do that. I think that Seth and Ben have touched on a few of them. There's lots of different kinds of courses out there. But I'll actually take this in a little bit of a different direction. This might kind of surprise some people given the context of this podcast. But I actually think that one of the most effective ways is for a provider to take something like a TCCC class or something involved with trauma care. Those courses a lot of times are a little bit more relevant to a lot of providers. There's not necessarily, you know, not every provider is going to be dealing with like a wilderness situation. But these days, as most listeners of this podcast, I think would agree, you got to be prepared for acts of terror and workplace violence and things of that nature. So you take a TCCC class, and they teach you, they help you move a little bit away from some of this rigid paradigms of thought. It's about doing what is most critical for the patient right in that moment, then moving them to safety and doing a little bit more. And so I find that a lot of providers kind of free their mind when they take a little bit of a TCCC course, and that makes it a little bit easier for them to then take the next step, and now you're in the woods, and we're doing things quite a bit differently. So I think that's kind of a way to go about it if people are trying to kind of go in cold, I guess.
Awesome. Good point, David. Dr. Joe, I saved you for last because I know Paragon – you know, you do so many different types of training at Paragon, including this kind of thing. So what are your thoughts on the subject?
Well, I think these guys stole my thunder in many ways. A lot of really great comments. I think it's be open-minded, be prepared to slay the dogma a little bit, and just go get engaged and do something. Is the best way to get it. There's so much to learn. It's such a broad area. There's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of complementary concepts and approaches and all that sort of stuff, no matter which sort of area you approach, whether it's, you know, USAR, DMAT, wilderness medicine, or anything in between all those. There's an awful lot of overlap and an awful lot of techniques and procedures and concepts to be learned. So just go do it, just like all my colleagues here said.
And I'm going to jump in here with our final keyword of this two-episode special segment on wilderness medicine and applications for the urban medic. And we're going to go ahead and use the words slaying dogma, because that's really what we've been talking about here, is really kind of putting some of these things behind us and thinking outside of the box and not living so rigidly within our given paradigm. So slaying dogma. Look at your podcast player on your device or computer or whatever you're listening to it, and note the elapsed time, and slaying dogma will be our final Con Ed keyword. So you can send that in. While I'm here, you can send those keywords and timestamps in to Terry@WMS.org. That's T-E-R-I at WMS.org. And that's where you'll email that to get the Wilderness Medicine Continuing Education credit towards the fellowship. And Seth, thanks so much for setting that up for us.
Absolutely.
So we'll go ahead and wrap up here. Dr. Joe, where can folks find out more about Paragon? You guys are the sponsors of the Disaster Podcast, and we really appreciate that. You provide a lot of what you call the experience in training, where you have people who have been involved with responses to given types of disasters. You use cadaver situations so people can actually work with human tissue rather than mannequins, and you do a lot of really exceptional things to bring specialized training for disaster preparedness to organizations and jurisdictions around the country. So where can folks find out more about how they can get you guys to come in?
Well, Paragon is really pleased to be a sponsor, and let me say a special thanks to all of our amazing guests, and I really just a superb podcast on many levels. But we can certainly be found on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. We're on Facebook under the same name, Paragon Medical Group, and our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU, and you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast as well.
Excellent. And Dr. Ben, why don't you tell us of where folks can find you, if they or a website you'd like to direct people to?
I'd say it's very easy to remember the last name because it also happens to be the blood types A, B, and O. But anyone's welcome to email me at benabo@gmail.com or benabo@ufl.edu. It's the University of Florida. Otherwise, you can just Google me and things will come up, or Facebook, and I'd be more than happy and to direct into whatever direction is best given your background or what information you're trying to find.
Ben, where can they find the article? I'm sure they're going to want to read that.
This article is in June 2016, so it's this month's issue of JEMS, Journal of Emergency Medical Services, which is also available on JEMS.com also.
Yeah, I'll try to find the link to that and make sure that's available in the show notes for everybody. If you don't get the magazine or have the website available, we'll have the link in the show notes over at DisasterPodcast.com for this episode. And thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, and it was a pleasure doing this with all of you. Thank you.
So, David,
We will do this again. I was just going to throw that out.
Absolutely.
We have so much great material that we haven't even touched on yet. So, Ben, don't go too far away.
And
I can always reach on the banana phone.
David, you're next. Where can folks find you if they want to reach out to you with some questions?
Well, I live in a few different places online, I guess. They can email me at david.pfeiffer@eku.edu if they'd like some guidance on EMS educational opportunities and paths and so forth like that. My personal email is dtpfeiffer@gmail.com. And I'm like Ben, I'm happy to correspond with anybody who's interested in wilderness medicine. And if you Google me, you'll also see my name pop up in association with a lot of the other organizations that were mentioned in my intro. And I am very active on social media, as many of the people on this podcast can attest to. So you can find me on Facebook probably a little too easily.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for coming on. Seth, why don't you let us know where we can find some of the resources you're associated with and where people can look you up?
Yeah, I'm also on Facebook, and I would say I'm quite embarrassed to say that a smartphone would be something I take out in the wilderness, because I think David would take it from me and monopolize it for our entire hike. He'd probably walk
below
into
the belt.
He was like posting, "Hey, I'm walking into a tree."
Below the tourniquet, Seth.
I do have a
below the Foley.
I do have an email address, which is hawk, like the bird, H-A-W-K, at A-Y-A, like alpha, yellow, alpha, dot Yale, Y-A-L-E, dot E-D-U. And I think for a website, since we discussed it, I'm quite excited about our effort to create the first Mountain Rescue Association-endorsed climbing rescue team here in the Southeast. That's AppalachianMountainRescue.org. And it's a great way for people to find out about our efforts here in the Southeast. There are links to the Mountain Rescue Association in general, and it also has links that you can reach me at.
Great. And thanks again for coming on the show. I think that leaves Kevin and Sam left here. So, Kevin, why don't you give folks your links and information?
Well, people can find me on the web at wildsafety.com, or they can send an email to me at training@wildsafety.com. And like David, and usually along with David, very active on Twitter, Facebook, and everything else. All those links are on the website. Or you can feel free to give me a call. You have to hit the website to find out that number, though. And I'll talk to anybody anytime about wilderness medicine or anything outdoorsy. And I'll leave it at that.
Outdoorsy it is. And Sam, how about you as we get down to the end here?
Well, you can probably find me on social media talking to these guys as much as they seem to be on there. And definitely want to entertain that and get them back here again. This has been an awesome podcast. But other than that, you can find me on social media under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 in the usual places, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. And they've given you a lot of information in which you can use to reach them, but you can also come up to the disasterpodcast.com and pose any questions you have for them, and I'm sure they'd be more than glad to come over and answer them for you. And Jamie, where do we find you?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media places, and I'm happy to correspond with just about everybody and love to hear from everyone. Of course, you can always find me over at disasterpodcast.com, like Sam said. Leave a comment over there on this or any of the episodes, and if you want to just reach out to any of the people that have been on this episode, you can leave a comment in the comments area, and we'll make sure they find out about that, and they can come back and leave a comment and reply. It's a great way to communicate and leave our comments out for everybody to get their questions answered. So without any more ado, you know, we've covered a lot in this big double episode that we've covered here, and a first for us to offer continuing education credit, which is kind of cool. So we'll try to see if there's opportunities to do that again in the future. But Sam, you know, wilderness medicine, disaster medicine, urban medicine, you know, it's still just not the same as what you do in a nice, well-lit hospital room or doctor's office or anything like that.
Yeah, these guys have certainly made a clear point of that. There's just, even within the wilderness medicine arena, there's just so many different specialties within that, and that is so much different than in the ER or even in the urban environment. So it's pretty clear that disaster medicine is not everyday medicine.